So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Petronella.
Thanks, Jay. Just adjust this. My name's Petronella, I'm an addict.
Hey, Petronella.
It is, surprisingly, really lovely to be here, because I'm really glad to be in an NA meeting. It is really scary, and I felt really anxious about coming here and sharing. I've shared at this meeting before a couple of times, actually, over time. And the last time I came here and shared, I felt completely insane. I'd had a really major life-changing event going on. And it probably wasn't the best time to come and do a chair because I actually couldn't think straight. And came away feeling like I'd talked nonsense, which, you know, because I'm an addict and because of my how my addiction affects me, I have a, you know, I'm very sensitive to worrying about what you think of me. And if I think that I've come here and talked to this number of people and made a bit of a fool of myself, then, you know, that's like major trauma that takes me back home with it going on inside my head. Oh, my God, why did I say that? Why didn't I say this? I must have sounded so stupid. And all that kind of nonsense that, you know, that's my addict kind of thinking. And it isn't enough to keep me from doing it again. It's just enough for me to need to say that that's how it felt. And I feel very fearful, and here I am, I'm doing it again, because this is what I do, and this is what I've learnt to do in recovery, to face my fears and to do the things that I am asked to do. And, you know, as the previous speaker said, there's something that I was told when I came into recovery, and that was to if I was asked to share, to agree to that if it's possible. And it was possible for me to do this, so here I am. And I've had to pray about it as well, because that's something that I do before I share. And really ask that God's will is done, not mine. Because my will is that you think I'm the funniest, most amazing, most beautiful, most fantastic woman you've ever seen and heard. That's not God's will. God's will is I carry a message of recovery, and hopefully that people who have, you know, if there are any people here who are new to the fellowship, that they'll be able to hear something about how I recovered from active addiction and how I continue to recover in the rooms of Narcotics Anonymous. And actually, that's really what my will is today, because it's a lot more comfortable when I am able to hand my will over to my higher power, my God. Yeah, so having got that one out of the way, I'm now wondering what I'm going to say. And I think I also need to say that I know there are people here who've heard my chair before, because I've been in recovery for more than 20 years now, so it's inevitable. And I'm not going to say, oh, sorry if you've heard my story, it's really boring. First of all, it wasn't boring. Using was boring, but the story of it isn't really boring. It's quite horrific, actually. And certainly the story of my recovery isn't boring, but that's the point for me is, every time I'm speaking, it's a different story. Not because I'm changing what happened in the past, but because I'm changing day to day. And I'm changing, you know, the person that came here and shared last time is not the same person that is speaking now. And I did some reading in the literature the other day, and I came across a reading that said something about, you know, this is a lifetime's work. This recovery that we're doing, it's a lifetime's work. It's not intended as something that, you know, we come in, do in 5 minutes and that's it, we're done. And that's certainly not my experience of recovery. And thank God for that, because when I first came into the rooms of NA, I was really... I was terrified, full of shame, full of guilt and remorse, but I was also full of fury and rage. So that person that I was is not a person I'd want to be all this time on. And it isn't something that... It wasn't something that I was able to change, as, you know, as it says in our literature, through any, you know, doctors, psychiatrists, any other means. And believe me, I tried to find a lot of... I looked in a lot of places for help for me, for the way I was, for the way I felt. And you know, as it says, none of them were sufficient because I wasn't treating what the real problem was. I wasn't trying to. Because actually I didn't think taking drugs was the problem. I thought I was the problem. So I thought if I could find a solution that involved me sorting my head out but managing to continue taking drugs, that would be fine. And strangely, that wasn't available. So I arrived in these rooms in a state of complete despair, hopelessness. Now, I don't think I can say hopelessness, because if I was completely hopeless, I guess I'd never made it here. But I certainly knew that I had not been able to control my life, my drug using, or anything that happened to me for a very long time. And, you know, I think when I came here, I had no trouble with step one. You know, I didn't have to actually sit down and read through step one and have it explained to me by anyone, because I was living a step one. And I was very aware that I had no control once I started... I don't know why I say once I started using, because once I started using at the age of 12, I never wanted to stop. And the only times I did stop were the times I had to. And obviously from the age of 12 till the age when I left school, I didn't have the means or the opportunity to use all day, every day. But as soon as I did, that's what I did. And, you know, I wasn't one of these addicts that... I wasn't one of these addicts that kind of managed to kind of keep things under control for a while. For me, my using became really serious really quickly, and my life became really chaotic really quickly. From the time that I began daily using and moved down to London, from that time... I think there was a period of a few months when it was fun and when I actually thought I was enjoying myself and I thought I was actually doing something that that made me free. And and you know, I had, when I picked up drugs, when I started using, and you know, the first drug that I picked up was alcohol, and I used, you know, when I've never had any problems with the bit in the reading. Alcohol is a drug. We're people with the disease of addiction, and we need to abstain from alcohol to recover. Well, I did have trouble about that when I was still using, because I thought, but I don't drink. I didn't drink as long as I had drugs, basically. If I didn't have drugs, I drank. But I can certainly see that from my very early, from the age of 12, I started drinking, and when I started drinking, I always drank to get drunk. I never drank to have a drink. I never drank to be sociable. It was always with the intention of becoming drunk, because I knew that when I reached a certain level of drunkenness that I would be able to converse with other people, I'd be able to be sociable, I'd be able to stop the thing going on in my head that prevented me from being able to feel part of the human race. And just for that little time, I'd be able to feel okay. Because I I'm aware that, you know, from as long as I can remember, I had this feeling that it really wasn't okay to be me, and I never felt comfortable in my own skin. I never felt that I was able to. I never felt comfortable in the company of any other person either. And, you know, the truth is, I still struggle with this stuff. I have a lot of fear around people. My fear is very much around that stuff about not being good enough, not saying the right thing, not doing the right thing, not all kinds of stuff. And I was a very frightened child. And drugs and alcohol gave me a release from that. You know, first the alcohol, and then I actively pursued drugs, and it was quite hard work. You know, when I was growing up in a small town in Lincolnshire, which is, believe me, the middle of nowhere, drugs weren't that easy to find. But I found them, and I really believe that we have a very great talent for that. That, you know, as addicts, wherever we go, we'll notice the person who's gouching, we'll notice the people going in and out of the house because we. You know, we're attuned to that. But even before I started daily using, I was sensitive to that stuff. You know, it kind of feels like that's my natural place. And I thought that that's where I found a place in the world. I thought that that's where, you know, when I was younger, when I found the people that used drugs, and when I hung out with the people that used drugs, I thought, this is it. I found my people. I found my community. And I felt a little bit like, well, you know, once I really get in with these people, I'll be all right. I'll be safe. And I never felt that, you know. I never achieved that, you know, no matter how many drugs I took, no matter how it went. You know, right from when I was a little schoolgirl going around the bigger boys' houses and, you know, being handed the end of a joint and thinking, oh, at last I've got a bit of dope. Right until my house was actually a crack house, I still never felt that I was really part of it and that I was really in and that I'd really found the in-group. You know, it didn't... I thought it gave me the illusion that I would actually feel all right and that I'd feel that I'd found my home, and I never did. Because it is an illusion, and it was an illusion. So by the time I, you know, it feels like there's so much to say, and not enough time to say it. By the time I got to NA, I had, as I say, I had. Been through a lot of the stages that, you know, it talks about in our literature, and it is a progressive illness. It was a progressive illness for me, and, you know, the progression was not just in the things that I would do for money, the way that I lived, the drugs. It wasn't in the drugs that I took and the amounts of drugs that I took. The progression was also in the way that I became more and more alienated from myself, more and more not a part of society anymore, more and more unable to have any kind of relationship with anybody that wasn't a drug user, because I felt so... I felt so ashamed of who I was. And... you know, it's a long time ago now that my using, but it doesn't feel like, oh, it's so distant, I can't remember what that was like. And I was talking to one of my sponsees yesterday, and she was asking me something about this. And and I got a kind of flashback of that feeling of what it's like to be sitting there, you know, in the place that I used to live, in this dirty, filthy, sordid, nasty place that I lived in. And, you know, what we were talking about is what, you know, whether there would ever be anything that would make that attractive again. And I just thought, what would be worth giving this up for? what would make it attractive? And yet, I'm aware that the insanity of addiction means that if I was not to do the things that I need to do to keep, to put some distance between myself and that drug, that my I would lose sight of that, that I would lose the knowledge that that's not worth giving this up for. Because actually, despite all of the terrible consequences that happened to me, I kept doing it again and again and again in the belief that it would make things better as my life became steadily worse and worse and worse. As I was arrested, as I went into prison, as my children were terribly affected by my using, as the relationship that I'd, you know, I used all the time with the same partner, but by the end of our using, it was as if we were two people living alongside each other. You know, we were no longer, I couldn't really say he was my partner, it was just we lived together and we used together. And you know what I remember from those last days really of using together was that our main conversation centered around who had had more drugs, who was more stoned than the other. And it was like always an argument like, no, you don't need some more beer, you're really stoned. No, I'm not, I'm tired, I'm just, my eyes are just closing because I'm tired. No, you know, and it went on and on, and it would, and what I would wait for was for him to nod out so that I could then steal the drugs that he had on, because he'd keep it down his trousers, and I'd go and take the drugs so that I could use them. And that's what our relationship was by the end of our using. And that was love, you know. We had a long-standing relationship, and this was the man that I thought was my soulmate, and I loved him dearly, and that he would do anything for me and I'd do anything for him, and this is what our relationship had degenerated into by this time. And I hated it, but I couldn't stop it. I couldn't do anything about it. And by the end of this, I really wanted to die. I didn't want to live anymore, because I didn't know how to stop it. I'd done all that stuff about thinking, right, I will just use the script, I won't use, and I had a Harley Street doctor who supplied me with Fiseptone pills, and I had boxes and boxes of them. And, you know, I'm not being grandiose saying this. I'm saying this because I found out a really horrible, harsh truth, which was that none of that would stop me using heroin. And, you know, when I sometimes, in latter years, I suppose I shouldn't talk about methadone programs and so on because it's an outside issue, but it kind of makes me laugh when people who haven't been where I've been talk about, oh, you know, as long as you give people enough methadone, they won't use on top of it. And I just think, clearly, you do not know about addiction. I had as much as I could possibly have used, and it was always, oh, but, you know, it's not holding me, really. It's no, oh, I don't feel anything. Oh, I'm just not sick, I'm not stoned. You know, all that kind of nonsense. That. So what I'm saying is, I have tried every method. You know, I did see psychiatrists, I did see doctors. I did have to see social services a lot because they had, because various things happened, particularly to my daughter, and because of my using. And generally, I was very good at explaining to them that none of the drug using was my fault, and it was all him. It was all my boyfriend. And that, you know, if he could only stop using drugs, then I'd be fine. And actually, I was a really good mother, and, you know, they shouldn't take my daughter away because, you know, I'd keep things under control. And I was really good at bullshitting. And I think that's really sad. And I'm really, you know, my daughter said to me since then that, she said to me that, she said, oh, they should have taken me away, the social services. She said, they should have taken me away. You weren't fit to be looking after me. And that's the truth. And I couldn't argue with that. I wasn't fit to be looking after her, and they should have taken her away. I'm really grateful that they didn't. I really loved my daughter. I really love her now. I couldn't stop using for her. I couldn't even control my using for her. I couldn't even cut down my using for her. And, you know, I come back to talking about I understood step one. That was part of my understanding of powerlessness. That nothing that I loved or cared about, nobody that I loved or care about came ahead of the drugs. So I thought I was, you know, I thought I was a good person. But if anything came between me and my drugs, then that would be sacrificed. I would betray anyone for my drugs. If I was sick, I'd do anything to get my drugs. And that's the truth. And that I believe that if I was to use drugs again, that would continue to be the truth. You know, and there's all sorts of things that people say, and there's all sorts of codes of honour that we have, like, oh, you shouldn't grasp people up. You know, I was arrested and I said things about, I grasped people up, I said things that I shouldn't have done because I thought if I did, I'd get out the police station quicker and I'd be able to use. And I wouldn't have said that to you a few years ago, well, not when I first came in NA, because I know that's terrible, or you know, shouldn't do that. But this is the truth. I mean, honestly, if you really understand powerlessness, then, and I do, then the reality is, I don't care what code of honour you've got, drugs are going to come first. That's my illness. That's my experience of addiction. So when I came to NA, I came not really believing that anything could help me. I certainly knew that there was no human power that could help me. And, you know, what I heard in these rooms was that thing about if we can't, that basically no human power can help us, but that if we ask our higher power for help, that there, then help is there. And that was a problem for me because I didn't believe in God. I'd been brought up with a religion that I had let go of a long time ago, and although I kind of believed in dark and evil things, I believed in demons. You know, I believed at one point that I was actually possessed by a demon, which I suppose is quite true, really, when you think about addiction. But I actually really believed that, you know, we kind of opened ourselves up to the darkness and dark forces by using, and so I believed in that. But I didn't really believe in God. So, you know, I've had a real dilemma here. And I lived in a very frightening world where, you know, evil existed, but the antidote to it didn't. And I came into the rooms and heard all this stuff about, you know, God. You know, it's there in the steps several times. And when I first came across that, I was really angry. Like, oh, who do they think they are? Oh, they should rewrite these. You know, how do they expect people to believe in this? You know, this is not right. And, you know, what happened for me was that when I became completely desperate, when I had to admit my complete defeat, I surrendered to this and thought, well, if you say this can help, I'm willing to give it a try. And I didn't believe it, but nevertheless, I practiced it. And, you know, I was... I haven't been able to get out to as many meetings as I'd like to recently, and I've been listening to some tapes and instead, or recordings, and I was listening to one today, and there was a very clear explanation of this where... I heard that said, the solution. The solution to our problem of addiction is twofold, and part of the solution is the fellowship that we have here. But so many of us stop there with just the fellowship. And actually, the other part of the solution is the spiritual awakening, and that we need that in order to be able to have the full benefit of this program, and we need it to stay clean. And, you know, my experience is when I first came into these rooms, it was quite a young fellowship, and there wasn't... We didn't have a deep understanding of working the steps. And actually, I didn't really work the steps for quite a long time. That's not how some people were working the steps, but there are a lot of people that weren't, that were just coming in, having the fellowship, coming to meetings, you know, talking about the programme, but not actually working the steps. And I didn't get it, you know. And, I don't know how many thousands of meetings I went to where I heard this is a 12-step programme and these are the steps we took. But that didn't actually somehow compute. That didn't actually, in my mind, that didn't translate to, therefore I need to take these steps if I want the programme of recovery, because actually I got clean just by coming into the rooms and you know, not picking up. And that was wonderful. Make no mistake, it was a wonderful contrast to my life before, and as soon as I put the drugs down, I was able to start making changes in my life that I had not been able to make before, surprisingly. I mean, you know, a big surprise here. But it used to baffle me why I never could change anything in my life while I was using, and then I found when I stopped using drugs that, oh, actually, I can turn up for appointments, do things I'm meant to do, start looking clean and tidy, clean my house, you know, do all this kind of stuff that I never used to do. And my life began to change. My life began to get better. And over time, and, you know, clearly I'm kind of telescoping this, it's not really that, at the time it felt like forever, and it felt like climbing Mount Everest, but over time, I got a bit of clean time and I started doing the things that I needed to do to be a responsible and productive member of society. And I actually got my life on some kind of track. You know, I got a job for the first time. I got a job that was legal, decent and honest for the first time in my life. I'd done a lot of work in my using, but it was mostly, well, it was all immoral or illegal, and you know, I started bringing up my daughter as a single parent. I left my partner because he continued to use, you know, and that all sounds so casual, but it was actually huge at the time. It was really painful stuff, and I never thought I'd be able to do it, and I was only able to do it with the support of the people in these rooms. And so over time, I got a bit of clean time. I got a bit of a normal life. I had a reasonable-looking house that was clean enough that I could actually invite people to come round and not have to keep them at the front door because it was so filthy and smelly. And that was great. You know, my life was much better. But I still had a lot of... I still had all the stuff that led me to use drugs in the first place. You know, I didn't pick up drugs because I was happy, joyous and free. I had all that misery and shame and a lot of that stuff before I ever picked up drugs. And then I acquired a whole load more when I was using, including a whole load of traumatic stuff from all the shit that happened when I was using. And, you know, when I put the drugs down, of course, I had a few feelings come up, just one or two, not too many, because I didn't do feelings. And I didn't know how to deal with them, and I didn't know what to do with myself. And, you know, in the first few years, and I know this might sound a bit off-putting, and it doesn't have to be this way, because actually there is a solution. But in the first few years of my recovery, I really struggled. It was really painful, and I was depressed, I was really finding life very hard, and yet so much better than using. And, you know, what... Just to kind of compress things, what changed that for me was that I eventually managed to get it into my brain that this is a 12-step program, and maybe if I worked the 12 steps, then I would find a solution, not to using drugs, but to the illness of addiction and the way that left me feeling. And that's been my experience. And, you know, there's some... It made a lot of sense once I started doing it. I think... I don't know where I was going with that, but anyway. You know, as I was saying, I didn't have a lot of difficulty. I found a sponsor and I started working the steps, and I didn't have a lot of difficulty with step one. And you know, that stuff was really raw and difficult to actually talk about. And there were things that I talked about in even in my step one, where I was talking about my powerlessness, that I thought I would never reveal to any human being. And, you know, there's a particular thing about that came up for me at that time, which was that my second daughter had died when she was a baby, and I believed it was because of the drugs that I was using, or because I tried to miscarry, because I really knew I didn't want to have a baby. I didn't want to have a second baby. I knew I wasn't looking after the child that I already had. And I dreaded having another baby because I felt that I wouldn't be able to. I just wouldn't be able to manage to look after another child. And actually, she was born with a serious heart condition, and she died when she was a week old. And you know, the reality is that although it was terrible, there was also a relief in it for me, and. Because when I had the baby, I realised that I loved her and I wouldn't be able to have her adopted like I thought I was going to do. And then I didn't know how I was going to manage, because I couldn't look after myself. Never mind another child as well. And then she died, and it was like... It felt like there was something, a relief in it. And I felt so guilty about that. I felt so bad about having had that thought, that, but I also felt so bad about not having wanted her, that I thought, I can't ever tell anyone this, because that's a really evil thing to do. What a terrible person I must be. And, you know, little by little, through doing those steps, I revealed this secret, and I still felt like I can never talk about that with anybody else, and I felt like it was the worst thing ever. And I walked around with it, and it really hurt, and I suffered for it for years. And yet now I'm able to say it here and say to you that, look, this is the truth, and this is what happened. And also say that I really grieve for my daughter. I've grieved for her since then. But that's the reality of my addiction. So step one, you know, tick that one off the list. Step two, the insanity of using. You know, yeah, fine, don't have a problem with that. And then, you know, getting to the point of step three, where the dilemma, you know, again, surfaces about, well... If I really am insane and unable to control any of this, what's left for me? And, you know, what I believed by this point was that I believed that it wasn't me that enabled me to stop using, because I felt like I'd had a spiritual experience at this point, that when I first came to NA and I was still using, and people said to me, you just need to put down the drugs, I didn't know how I was ever going to do that. I didn't know how to do that. And I didn't. I really believed I can't do this myself. So I prayed to God. And I didn't believe in God, but I prayed and said, help me, do this for me, because I really can't do it. And I really believe it was taken from me, because I was given the power to do it. So when it came to step three, I'd had that experience that, you know, when I was really desperate and I prayed, then help was given. And that was something that I continued to experience. And you know, I still continue to experience that. You know, I've had a really difficult kind of character defect that I've been dealing with recently around fear and around, actually around telling people, being assertive with people and telling people what I need to, and standing up for myself in certain circumstances. And I really had to just pray and hand it over and say, please, God, I can't do this. Help me with it. Because I knew what I should do and I knew how I should deal with it, but I couldn't do it. And today I've had two conversations with different people that I needed to set some boundaries with, and I've done that. And I believe today that I was given the power to do that by my higher power. And, you know, talking about character defects, talking about that step, it wasn't until quite some time into the programme that I realised that step seven says, we humbly ask God to remove these shortcomings. Because I thought, somehow, that it said we have to remove our shortcomings. And, you know, I'd done that step four and that step five, and found out exactly what my shortcomings were, and there are a lot of them, and they were really ingrained, and that, you know, a lot of it came down to fear. And you know, I spoke about before, I had this terrible fear. And a lot of my manipulative, controlling behaviours, a lot of the stuff that I did was around this terrible fear that I would never get what I needed and never get my needs met. So I had to get everything for myself. And when I realised this in it, doing that step, those steps, and I came to looking at my character defects and needing them to be removed, again, I had no idea how I was going to do that, but I had a sponsor who was able to point out to me that this is not, you know, it's not for me to do, basically, that it's about my surrendering and letting my higher power do it for me. I'm really aware that I'm running out of time, and I feel like I've got a lot more to say about the steps, and don't have time to do that. But so briefly, I guess what I really want to just talk about, just for a couple of minutes, about the steps is this: that you know, after working through the steps, and I really, if I can only say one thing to you tonight that sticks, it is this: that, you know, for me, in my experience, working the steps all the way through with a sponsor who was able to guide me in them was a profound experience that profoundly changed my recovery. And step 12 does talk about a spiritual awakening, and for me, the spiritual awakening is one that took away the terrible feelings that I constantly had with me, the feeling of being unable to accept life on life's terms, unable to, you know, I spoke earlier about this terrible dilemma I had, that I saw the world as a kind of dangerous, evil, unsafe place, and that carried on in my recovery. And for me, the spiritual awakening that I had as a result of working the steps gave me freedom from that, and I was able to see the world, you know, in a different light. And we talk about this being a disease of negativity, and that's, you know, that's still available to me if I want it, but I'm really aware that I can choose something different today. And you know, I never understood the saying about, I used to get really angry about people saying that saying about misery is optional. But actually, the whole of that saying, I found out at some point, is pain is inevitable, but misery is optional. And I actually found out what that meant. And if that doesn't mean anything to you now, keep coming back, because one day, if you work the programme, it will. And trust me, that is such a gift. When I found that out, that was such a gift. And, you know, the last thing I want to say about that, Steph, is that in order to have that spiritual awakening, that I needed to be aware of the second part of the step, which is, I think, sometimes not given a lot of attention. But it is about practicing these principles in all my affairs. And that means practicing spiritual principles in all my affairs. And I am nothing like a perfect person. I'm nothing like a saint. So I don't do that perfectly. But I do aim to practice these principles in all my affairs. And that means principles, for instance, of honesty, principles of love, generosity. And I choose to have a recovery in which I don't do any of the behaviours that I used to do in my using. So it's not consistent with practicing these principles in all my affairs to do dishonest things, to act out of fear. Because that stuff is about fear, that I won't have enough. You know, when I first came into recovery, I did various things like, you know, didn't pay for my TV licence because I thought, well, I can't afford to, so how can I? And all that happened, and that was about my fear that I didn't have enough. And all that happened was I ended up with a whole lot more fear. So practicing these principles in all my affairs gives me peace of mind, because I don't have to worry about who's going to knock on my door. I don't have to worry about anyone finding out anything that I'm doing. I don't have to worry today. And I'm kind of running out of time. I haven't really had a chance to say anything about where I am today. My life has been transformed enormously, even in the last 2 or 3 years. And you know, some of you may know I've embarked on parenting again, because I'm fostering a child who's been affected by this illness. And so that's what's going on for me at the moment, and I haven't been able to get to the meetings that I used to get to because I'm looking after him at home, and that's been amazing and difficult. And I have an illness at the moment that's really been very difficult to adjust to, but that's an ongoing process, and I'm needing to kind of learn how to surrender to that and about how that's made my life different. And I guess the reason why I'm saying this is because I want to say to you that this really is a lifetime's work. And I know that, you know, I've been here more than 20 years, and I've been through 2 or 3 different major phases in my life, and I know there's more to come. I know that, and I've got plans for it. You know, I really have some big plans about what I'm going to be doing with my life. And that's the freedom that I've been given by this programme. And I'm really grateful for that. And I do echo what the previous speaker said about it's all about keep coming back. Mm-hmm. And I certainly intend to do that. Thank you.